Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we're going to be discussing a publication by Dr. Sadia Jamil. Sadia is Assistant Professor at the School of International Communications, where she is also the Director of Research and the Director of the Institute of Mobile Studies.
Sadia holds a PhD in Journalism and Communications from the University of Queensland and is the country representative for the United Arab Emirates and China for the Asian Media Information and Communications Center. She's the co-editor of the Palgrave book series, Global Transformations in Media and Communication.
One of Sadia's many recent publications is titled The Changing Ethnic News Media Landscapes, Implications of Technological Convergence in Multicultural Pakistan and Russia, and is soon to be published in the Journal of Multicultural Discourses. So, for me, this one is much more in my area this time, which, of course, delights me somewhat. And Sadia is a close colleague of mine.
So you have a conflict of interest this time.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I didn't think that through.
So we want nothing but silence, Mary. No, I'm just joking.
Really?
I can give you nothing but silence.
If you want nothing but silence, you know, go ahead, Derek.
I'm used to that. So I'm very happy if you communicate with me.
Well, I am interested, though, to see what you thought of this paper, in essence, given that it is somewhat outside of your field, perhaps.
My field broadly would include something called discourse analysis.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Linguistics approaches discourse analysis in a slightly different way. So this is really interesting to me. But weirdly enough, like many linguists, I got hooked into the field by the work of Noam Chomsky. And Chomsky, with Edward S. Herman, wrote a book called Manufacturing Consent.
Whoa, is there any more dinosaurs you'd like to?
I am not going to nod and smile about that.
Well, this one obviously interests me because we're talking about technological convergence and we're talking about social media in this way. So I'm sure kind of everyone you mentioned is still very much relevant, but we are somewhat updating this in the last kind of 30 years.
In fact, it's relevant to mainstream media.
Okay.
But what we're talking about here, of course, is ethnic journalists and the types of alternate media that those individuals might be involved with.
So is that, mainstream media even still relevant as a concept?
I don't know why you're asking me.
Oh, we should actually ask the expert that we have. Welcome, Sadia.
Welcome. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Derek, for inviting me. It's such a great pleasure to join you this morning for the podcast.
It's a great pleasure to have you. Thank you very much for giving up your time. Could you please then give us an overview of your paper?
All right. So as Derek mentioned about the title of my article, it's about the changing ethnic news media landscape, which is not exactly applicable to changing only to ethnic news media. We can say that mainstream news media is also evolving around the globe because of the technological transformations that we are experiencing. But this paper exclusively focuses on ethnic news media in multicultural societies, and we have taken the examples of Pakistan and Russia specifically. Many of the people wondered why we have compared the cases of Pakistan and Russia, because both of the countries, they have quite similar ethnic media landscape, and still they draw a lot of distinctions. They differentiate also. So that's the reason it was quite interesting for us. For example, Russia has more than 2,200 ethnic news media landscape, ethnic news media outlets operating in different local ethnic languages, whereas Pakistan has a very rich ethnic news media. And one of the basic queries that we received during the development of this project, why we didn't compare India and Pakistan, because India has a very rich ethnic news media landscape. However, we did have some solid reasons for picking Pakistan and Russia. So the ownership structure of ethnic news media and in Pakistan and Russia, they are quite similar. Both of the countries, the governments in both countries, they really feed ethnic news media outlets, particularly newspapers. So it is quite government-fed media. And they are not as such privately owned, unlike the case of India. So we had really good solid reason to pick the cases of Pakistan and Russia. Both are multicultural, both are very rich in ethnic groups and minorities, and they are very rich in terms of ethnic media landscape. And that's the reason we wanted to compare how technology is transforming ethnic journalist practices in both countries. Together with the framework of technological convergence, we picked cultural discourse studies as a framework because we wanted to analyze how technology is enabling ethnic journalists to have more communicative power. We're in a situation when ethnic minorities might be considered as marginalized and less vocal in conflict countries like Russia and Pakistan. So that was the overall background of this project.
That's interesting. You immediately preempted my first question, which was basically, why exactly did you choose China and Russia, these two countries specifically, to analyze? Looking at the article, it's a co-authored article. So you authored it with two other academics who are also, I think, are they both based in Russia, are they?
Yes.
Right. So why specifically and how did you guys get together and decide to produce this research? Is there a story behind this?
Sure, there is a long story. I think it dates back to 2017. So the co-authors of this article, they are my IAMCR colleagues. So I am the chair of IAMCR Journalism. IAMCR, International Association of Media and Communication Research. So I am the section head for Journalism Research and Education section, and Anna is the chair for Digital Divide Working Group. So together, like it's almost 6 years back, we thought that we should be working together on a digital divide project or something that underpins technology informing journalistic practice. And it was originally thought that we will be contributing a publication for IAMCR. However, we ended up deciding that we will be working on ethnic news media in the global south, and we ended up having contract with Palgrave. So we did an edited volume together, incorporating studies from Latin America, Africa, Middle East, South Asia, and of course, Russia. And we had really wonderful comparisons of ethnic news media landscape in these regions of the world. So that was the first ever edited volume that specifically talked about ethnic journalistic practice in the global south. That was never contributed before. So we had a lot of studies back to the global north, but there was not any representative publication or scholarly work from the global south. So when we were working on that edited volume, we realized that we really need to expand some research work other than editing the volume. And then in 2018, I started working back to Pakistan, collecting the qualitative data. And Anna, who was based in Russia, she thought that, okay, she will be collecting data in Russia. However, unfortunately, pandemic happened. And the second phase of...
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yes. And luckily, I could manage to finish my data collection just before pandemic. But she ended up having really a lot of struggle and problems to collect the data, and she had to wait a lot. So she combined some of the online interviews with face-to-face interviews. And of course, the lockdown back to South Asia and Middle East and Russia was not as severe as in China. So of course, we could meet journalists even in person. So we managed to complete the data collection by 2020, and then it took a long time for the review process of the journal, and finally, after 3 years' time, the article is about to release. So that's a story how we developed this research mm-hmm. project, which is of course not the end of the story because we are already planning to expand this work further based on how digital divide is impacting ethnic journalists' capacity to transform their mm-hmm. practices.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that you mentioned the time frame there.
Yeah.
You mentioned this is an entire 6 years.
Yes.
This has been in the pipeline.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe our more junior listeners, in essence, can actually be reassured there that yes, this stuff takes a long time. It does take a while in that way. You mention a lot the term practices and journalist practices or journalistic practices. Can you explain what you actually mean by those things?
In a very layman language, if somebody has to understand journalistic practice in a very simpler way, it's the work, routine work that they undertake.
Okay.
So whatever they perform in their newsroom or in the field, this is their practice. This is their professional practice. Other than their routine work is not considered as professional practice. This is how we define journalistic practice. And that should be underpinned by the professional code of conduct and the norms and ethics guided by the professional bodies within which context they operate. Mm. So that defines practice.
So, sorry, can I jump in? Because again, this isn't my field. And so I'm very curious about clarifying some things. So when we're talking about new media and the idea of a journalist within contemporary framework, where's the line between a journalist and kind of an amateur content producer? So where does the kind of maybe social mission versus the profession?
That's a very interesting question, Derek. And I think quite often I receive this question. When you define a professional journalist can be held accountable and responsible. So for example, if I'm a professional journalist, I'm working, operating for a news organization, you can hold me accountable based on the legal or regulatory framework of the context within which I'm operating. However, you cannot hold any amateur or citizen journalist accountable under the same regulation that you apply on a professional journalist. So, for example, you are not a professional journalist. You are not working for a news organization. Your right to freedom of expression might have a different boundary as a citizen or a public than for a journalist. Many people argue that the regulatory framework or right to access to information or right to freedom to expression, how it is different for a professional journalist. It is. And at times, it is not an absolute right. So these boundaries basically define, or sometimes many people argue, cage a professional journalist. Because if you have right to freedom of expression, if you have right to access to information, you are accountable and responsible to use that right. And every country, they have a different legal framework. They have different ethical boundaries, and that are defined by the history, culture, religion, of course, that define the level of the boundary.
So do you find with ethnic news media, which may be very, very small organizations in some case, that boundary can become a little bit blurry, or is it very clear still?
Well, if you talk about that professional boundary, it is same for ethnic news media or the mainstream news media. If you are a professional journalist, no matter what sort of duty or task you are performing or which type of news organization you are working for, you will be held accountable. So the boundary will remain strict. A professional journalist will remain professional journalist. For example, if you have an ethical code of conduct that is uniform and standardized for a journalist working in a mainstream news media or a journalist working for an ethnic news media. So it doesn't make any changes when it comes to accountability or responsibility factor. It is all same.
Great. Thank you.
Interesting. You mention again and again about the term changes. And it's obviously important because it is actually part of your title. You talk about the changing ethnic news media landscapes. I notice that you say changing rather than the changes, which suggests to me that this is very much, of course, an ongoing process. And it so feels like every time you're studying it, then it must have changed since, and it's continuing to change. And it's a field that's changing so quickly at the same time, in essence. All right. So how exactly do you study a field that is ultimately moving so fast? Because it sort of feels like you get your data and then sort of so quickly it would be out of date in some way, in essence. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's one of the interesting questions, because we had a debate over this word changing. When we were drafting the title, we did have a discussion with the editor-in-chief of the journal. Why do you choose the word changing. And we did respond back to the editor. We believe that the struggle of the ethnic journalist keep going because the rights, the exercise for the journalistic right is never ending. And we see that countries, for example, like Pakistan or Russia, that the struggle keeps going. And we have a lot of countries. It's not very stagnant. Like, for example, we give the example of the freedom of expression right back to United States, which is absolute. It is stagnant since centuries. But if you go back to, if I may use the word, conflict-ridden countries, everything keeps changing because the struggle by minorities or professionals, it keeps going. And I think that's the reason we need to say changing, because it keeps on changing with different times of period. And I think that's an intriguing point for a lot of researchers. Of course, this is not the end point. If we go back and collect the data now, we may find something new. So that's the reason we use changing, even in terms of technology, in terms of the struggle for the rights, even in terms of the discourse. These are the contexts that keep changing. Mm. They are not stagnant. Unlike many of the, even we see changes in established democracies. However, as I mentioned, conflict-ridden countries, they are more sensitive because maybe Derek can add more where the discourses keep going on a regular basis.
Sure, sure. I sort of almost feel like I'm obligated to ask about the term conflict-ridden countries, because it does sort of feel like we're opening up a huge can of worms here in essence. But can you perhaps elaborate on what exactly you mean by this term, maybe? Or try?
Yeah.
Or run away, it's okay?
No. Okay, when we think about conflict, for example, okay, starting from the case of Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
So if you see the political, religious, and cultural structure of Pakistan, it's all underpinned by conflict.
Mm-hmm.
If you pick religion, for example, the country is 97% Muslim population. However, there are sectarian conflicts and they keep going. If you go back and look in the history of the politics, you see that the tension never ends. And that political tension stems from the ethnic clash between different provinces.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the ethnic minorities in Pakistan, they feel that they are marginalized, they are deprived. And that's the reason we pay focus to ethnic news media. How do they give representation? You know, how do they facilitate discourse about different kind of conflicts,
mm-hmm.
which we observe on a daily routine basis? And then we broadly categorize the cultural conflict. When I talk about cultural conflict, it might be related to the overall national identity construction problem. Is it a Pakistani identity? Is it a Muslim identity? Is it an extremist identity? So altogether, we see a lot of conflicts back to Pakistan,
mm-hmm.
and which is not just related to politics, religion, or culture, but we have territorial disputes, for example, Kashmir. So that's the reason we use the terminology conflict-ridden countries. If you go back to Russia, other than political issues, they have very rich ethnic culture. There are a lot of ethnic minorities in Russia, and which I believe, roughly I can say that they do have clashes, and mm-hmm. which is unavoidable. We can expect that. So that's the reason we use the term conflict-ridden countries, where we don't see stability over at least a considerable period of time, you know.
Well, that certainly makes sense. When I'm sort of listening to you describe these countries, what I'm getting a impression of is just how rich these are in terms of diversity, in terms of ethnicity, and all of these different sort of groups in particular. And I can totally understand why they would make an excellent kind of case study for this topic. What surprises me then as well is that this hasn't been done before. I mean, you said previously, and you mentioned this in the article, and you said when you were introducing your paper that there was a huge gap here. Why is there such a huge gap in studies of ethnic media in two countries that have huge ethnic populations and huge media and that are economically very significant and politically significant on the global scene? So why do we have this absence?
I think if you ask me about both countries, for example, if you take the examples of Pakistan and Russia, people are more tempted to research about mainstream news media. They are very picky about that. And that's the reason we feel that altogether, even ethnic journalists, they are part of marginalized community.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody bothers to talk about them. I remember when I visited Norway last month, I was communicating, why you people don't talk about safety of ethnic journalists? Why do you count the death toll of journalists working for the mainstream media? And we realized that we hardly pay attention to the safety of journalists who are working for ethnic news media. So I think they are altogether part of marginalized communities by themselves. And that is unfortunate. Another interesting point is I don't understand any ethnic language back to Pakistan because my parents were born in India.
Oh,
and
my
forefathers are from Middle East. So I had one of the criticism when I was doing this research and when I was speaking to journalists, I was conducting their interview in English. And I had one person, research assistant, helping me to translate everything in Urdu language if I was not able to communicate properly. And then I had a major criticism as a researcher. If you don't understand the local culture well, and if you are not familiar with that, how can you address the issue of representation?
Do you think that was a valid criticism?
I think that was a valid criticism. And I remember I spent extended period of time with ethnic journalists back to Karachi that I could only afford to stay with. And then I had a lot of meetings with ethnic journalists from other parts of the country just to address that criticism. Though I did not perform ethnography, I didn't take part of any participant observation, but I did spend enough time with them just to address that criticism.
On the contrary, you could also argue that your, I found this in my own research, that your position as an outsider often gives you access in ways that you perhaps wouldn't if you were part of that community.
But you know, like Mary, I should tell you, we need to take care of the cultural sensitivity when you operate with journalists in culturally sensitive countries. So for example, if you have to really dig out the data, you have to be very careful when you present the argument. So basically you take the feedback and you try to address the feedback. So I took that criticism that anyway, I'm not coming originally from the ethnic background, any of the ethnic backgrounds of Pakistan. And of course, I don't have that much knowledge. Mm-hmm. But still, I could make sure that we do understand the issue of representation, which any of the local researchers could not understand before.
Were there any examples in your research of when you felt that this perhaps misunderstanding had taken place?
On a couple of occasions, yes. When I did try to access local journalist unions, and they are all run by different journalists who are from the local ethnic group and they are leaders of ethnic political parties. And it was really challenging to communicate them and to make them understand that we can present issues well because we understand the gravity of the rights and the struggle that they are doing. So it has nothing to do with the background from where you are coming from where you were born, who were the forefathers. It has nothing to do. It is like a very objective researcher perspective that can help to underline their issues and whatever they are facing, you know, in terms of representation and any of the communicating power issues, you know.
Sure, sure. It sort of seems like you're talking about kind of ethnic journalists are more likely to use non-mainstream media, which is sort of a good reason to study this. But I sort of float the idea that are people really still studying the mainstream media anyway? Because it almost seems so much less relevant in our environment now. Everything that impacts you is social media, is kind of all of the various platforms, is kind of all of the various kind of blogs and videos, everything like that. So is there anyone actually purely studying the mainstream media and ignoring that?
The answer is partially yes. In the recent years, we have observed a shift of research focus when we study mainstream news media. So there is a quite growing interest in the global north and global south of researching artificial intelligence and how AI-driven transformations are changing mainstream news media. So you can say that it's not that people have just abandoned the research about mainstream news media. Mm-hmm. It's just that they are now focusing on different aspects which have not been explored before. Mm-hmm. For example, AI mm-hmm. and the mainstream news media. For example, science journalism, environmental journalism. These are the areas that have never been explored before. And thanks to the pandemic, during the pandemic, everybody started thinking about science, health, environment. So these are the things that we have noticed, that there is a shift in the focus of research, unlike the research topics that we used to observe before. I'm not sure how long it will take in the near future if we have enough research into these areas and how much it will grow further. But I agree with you that the research about mainstream news media is declining.
I'm really interested in that shift that you have noticed. I find that fascinating. Is there a difference between it in the global south, shall we say, as opposed to kind of the West that people have focused on before? When you're looking at countries like Pakistan, like Russia, in essence, it seems that what you're saying is that the focus of studying media in these countries has been mainstream media, but really the significance and what's happening, what should be studied, is social media. Is that particularly different? And has there been a shift from Europe and America and the places where you say this kind of research has previously been focused?
Look, research in the global north is something...
Is the global north actually a term?
Yes. Why we do that? Because we do have a bifurcation of publications from the global north, global south. I don't know if it's something appropriate or not. But if you have heard about the Palgrave series of journalism in the global south, that is exclusively about research into global south and why it has been established. Because research is a serious business in Western countries, or roughly the global north. So it's very difficult to motivate researchers to have like a really proper, well-protocoled research. And unfortunately, journalism, communication, these are the areas that are not considered as something, a serious discipline in terms of investigation. So people are more tempted about science, technology. If you go and do a research about disciplines, you will see people are more motivated to talk about science, technology, but they are not very interested to talk about social science disciplines and humanities in the countries of the global south. So having said that, of course, we do face a challenge in terms of really quality research when it comes to journalism. It encompasses everything, mainstream news media, ethnic news media, social media. And we rely on a lot of literature that comes from the global north. And then we highlight the research gap. But that is not helpful when we take a local perspective. That was the reason I think Palgrave took the initiative to launch its series into journalism in the global south. That was the motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And now IMCR has a separate division that bifurcates the research coming from the global north and the global south so that people have a chance to find out the comparison, what is happening in the West, what is happening in the other parts of the world. And I think which is constructive in a way that it helps you to locate the proper research gaps in the knowledge and what can be further done.
So I have quite a few what are probably very simple questions. My frame for this, I'm from Canada, so what we would consider ethnic news media would be of two types. There would be the Indigenous people's news media, and then there would be immigrant communities' news media. And at one point, people would brag about, you know, there's 180 plus different language publications in Toronto alone, for example. Anyway, I'm just curious in your research, obviously you have two situations in Pakistan and Russia. How much of that falls into that kind of model? Is there constructions of immigrant communities that also have their news media, or is it mostly kind of marginalized Indigenous or local communities?
I think, Derek, if you're referring to the case of Canada, which is quite similar to New Zealand, Australia, they have Indigenous ethnic news media and they have immigrant ethnic news media, which is not the case of Pakistan and Russia, because we don't have migrants. And if you talk about, for example, the demographic of subcontinent, so we did have partition in 1947. But we don't see any major shift of ethnic news media coming from India to Pakistan. So what was built in terms of ethnic media landscape that was originally situated in the parts which are now Pakistan? Similarly with Russia. So we don't see a lot of immigrants going to Russia and get settled and they establish their own. We have a terminology, diasporic media also. So they don't build up. So this is something that comes from the people who are actually originally situated. That's a very good point, how we differentiate people who are originally situated at some place with indigenous people. Well, we don't have any tribal ethnic culture. So that's the reason we just call it just ethnic, who are marginalized, who are not mainstream, and they have their own ethnic culture, subculture. They have their own ethnic language, or in Pakistan, they use the terminology provincial language as well. So either they use ethnic language or provincial language. So each province is marked by one ethnic language. That's it. So that's a very interesting case. So unlike countries like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and even in Latin America, we don't have very specific indigenous ethnic media coming from originally from the tribes, and we don't have any immigrant media, for example. And therefore, we don't have any well-established diasporic media that we observe in countries like Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, for example.
That's really interesting. So a couple of times now, you've talked about ethnicity, you've talked about language, and in some ways, you're using the cultural salience of those terms interchangeably. So I'm just curious here. I noticed at one point in your article, when you were talking about interviewing, you were interviewing the people from Pakistan in Urdu, which you referred to as their mother tongue. And so I'm a linguist, right? So I pick up on this. So I'm kind of fascinated to think about, you know, is this their mother tongue if they are working as ethnic minority journalists? Or would they identify their ethnicity as being of a different language?
Okay, that's one of the interesting questions, because he reminded me of one of the reviewers. He raised the exact same question. How do you distinguish between the mother tongue and the language in which they operate?
Derek, were you reviewing this article?
I cannot reveal that. This is a double-blind process.
We had to, and that was the same case back to Russia. They mentioned, oh, they were interviewed in Russian language. So, and we had to give a whole range of justification. So when we say mother tongue, it refers to official language as well. So for example, if you are born in Russia and in Pakistan, technically you will be speaking official language, which is a national language. So we had to justify that in the response to the reviewers, though we didn't add that considering the length of the article in the methodology. So we had to justify, we consider mother tongue as the national language, which every person who borns in those countries, they learn how to speak up. And the ethnic language is something which is operational language in which they operate to work in that media, for example. I know a lot of people, in fact, the journalists to whom I interviewed, they are not originally Pakistanis, by the way. And they had the same hybrid history like me. Somebody like coming from India, or one of the journalists, they had the same history like me. Their forefathers came from Middle East. So Arabic is not my mother tongue because I was born in Pakistan. So they don't consider Arabic as my mother tongue. It can be my second language. So same with those journalists. They learned how to speak, for example, Punjabi, Sindhi, Pashto, because they were operating in the country. So they learned it. So we call it operational language, not exactly the ethnic language. So we had to explain, I remember that is the exact same question. And we had to write an essay to differentiate between national language and the operational language in which journalists operate. But that makes sense. That's a very interesting point, because we are talking about media, language, and communicative power of journalists.
Love to read your mini essay, by the way, because this is an issue that has kind of plagued linguists for a long time, in the sense of, you know, you seem to be indicating that our mother is actually the state, not the woman who gave birth to us. And presumably taught us our first language. So I'm not sure we just because we're born in the same country, we share the same mother.
That's something quite interesting, because in that case, for example, if I was born in Karachi, so technically they will put my mother tongue as Urdu, no matter I'm proficient or not. And if I'm good in Arabic, for example, because I have Arab ancestry, they will not put it in my document Arabic as my mother language. And they will just, that's a secondary language. So, yeah.
So the core of the question here is interesting, because you brought up some fascinating corollaries here, where some of the people who might be working within the ethnic news media may not have initially that mother tongue or the identification with the local ethnic group. Do they then have an identification with the language group? And what is that relationship between ethnicity and language?
I would say that the relationship between ethnicity and language in that way is quite weak and blurred, or I would say undefined. For example, if I am ethnic journalist, in my case, it will be very undefined. How do they define that? It might be considered as political if I say that, but if you look at my passport, and when they scan my passport, they mention the entire history. My parents were born in India. It goes into my documents. I was born in Karachi, so they issue that Pakistani ID to me. And then they put all the history. So how do you define ethnic identity, for example, in that way? If you go back and ask me, okay, who is she? They will neither say me, she doesn't belong to any ethnicity of Pakistan. So who am I? Well, technically just a Pakistani national, but not having any ethnic identity. That's the problem. And then it comes about the language. So the relationship between ethnicity and language, I don't see it as blurred, but rather undefined. In many cases, for example, I know a lot of journalists who were actually originally from different province, but they start operating in different province and they operate in a different ethnic language. So it becomes quite undefined, and then we agreed that we will call it as operational language, operational ethnic language, because identity in that way is quite contested. Like, for example, in my case, I say that my identity is quite contested. I don't say unknown, but I would say contested, because I am not able to relate with any culture or identity very properly. You know, like in case of indigenous people, they say, we belong to that indigenous culture. But even in terms to culture, that applies on culture. What culture do you practice exactly? Do you practice a Pakistani culture, Indian culture, Muslim culture, Arab culture? That becomes very, I would say, undefined. Not blurred, but undefined in that way.
It's very interesting, because the way you're describing this brings to mind the issue of third culture children, this type of idea, which many of us who've come to live and work in China, of course, are raising children who may have the same kind of cultural ambiguities in terms of, do they identify with a home culture or some sort of local culture? You know, what languages do they choose to speak? I think what exacerbates it here is the question of the ethnic media. So if I'm then responsible for producing the news content in a particular language for a particular ethnic group, how closely do I need to identify with that group to do that successfully?
I think that's one of the issues when it comes to representation. If you are operating with undefined identity, for example, you're working with an operational language, which you actually don't speak originally. That's not even your mother tongue. It ultimately impacts on the issue of representation and how vocally you can represent the issues. And that's the reason they remain marginalized, unlike the mainstream news media, which is quite clear. They operate in the national language, for example, or official language. They know how to develop or facilitate the discourse. But what is happening in ethnic news media is the issue of representation because of the undefined identity. And therefore, people, they don't relate well with the issue, for example. If I have to take the example of Russia, I was told by my colleague that that issue of operational language and the identity, for example, in case of Tatar, they are not even able to represent very properly. And I see the same problem back to Pakistan also. They don't have a proper identity. They don't have the proper grown-up ethnic culture. And if you are just working for ethnic news media for the sake of a job, maybe for the sake of passion, that doesn't constitute ethnic journalism. It doesn't serve the purpose or the mission of ethnic news media, which is to give voice and representation to marginalized communities. Unfortunately, it's very, I would say, it's all about operationalism.
This brings up one question that I had, which was about one of your findings here, which is that you said that the ethnic news media can promote a form of collective identity amongst this group. But you also said that that wasn't necessarily a good thing, and that that can foster division in these identities here. So this seems quite contradictory in some ways to the idea of this importance of ethnic identity.
Why we emphasize the idea of collective identity? Because we understand there are a lot of clashes in these countries. If you take the examples of Pakistan, for example, the political dispute in Pakistan is stemmed from ethnic clashes. And that's the reason the central or the federal government is weak, because there is contest of power between different ethnic groups. So what we emphasize that ethnic news media not only provide representation to marginalized communities, but rather they create a societal cohesion and bring the peace for proper collectivism. For example, we see a lot of division between four provinces of Pakistan. But when it comes to the central, they never have any consensus. The issue is not that severe back to Russia, for example, because they are not that much politically segregated, maybe because of the control of the federal government. But the federal government or the centralized control is quite weak back to Pakistan because of the ethnic clashes, which is a major difference between Pakistan and Russia. So what we emphasize collectively, that ethnic news media can help to refuel the ethnic identity. At the same time, it can serve to create social cohesion and to create a collective identity that, okay, we are part of one, instead of fueling the clash, you know. So that communicative power is not just for separate ethnic groups. The communicative power is for one voice. And why it is crucial for the case of Pakistan? Because a country is suffering because of these ethnic clashes. The political dispute is basically ethnic, not just corruption, but the ethnic dispute. So either you divide the country into four pieces, or you get a collective voice. And ethnic news media needs to play a role, which is much problematic as compared to Russia, because Russia has very strong state control, centralized control. Yeah,
I understand that the article is coming out shortly, so it's not yet available, but it will be very soon. So in that way, I can't really ask you about any criticism of the article so far. However, is there some criticism of the field and anything that you can anticipate is going to be perhaps controversial about the article?
Well, I can share the criticism that we faced during the review process, and we can anticipate the similar sort of criticism once the article will be out. So one of the major criticisms was, why the case of Pakistan and Russia? Why not to compare, for example, India and Pakistan? Because they were just one before partition, and both countries, they have rich ethnic media. That was the first criticism. And the other criticism was about the language thing. The same question, how do you define ethnic identity and the relationship between language and ethnic identity? And we had to address that during the review process, that we considered it as national language and then operational language. So we anticipate that debate to keep going. Why Pakistan and Russia, and what exactly we would like to expand further in terms of comparison, and what exactly is the outcome of that comparison between Pakistan and Russia? I think that can be possible criticism.
I think if they start that debate, then you could just send them a copy of this podcast.
One more thing in terms of discussing the technological convergence, because we haven't dealt too much with that. And I'm going to refer to another dinosaur, just upset Mary a bit more.
I'm so upset. I'm majorly upset.
I do my best.
Do you see this face? This is an upset face.
So you make a very good distinction between the ideas of technological convergence, media convergence, and network convergence. But I was kind of thinking along these lines, when you have this media convergence where you have different types of media suddenly being available for the dissemination of news items, and in this case, particularly these ethnic news media sources. So I'm going to quote back to Marshall McLuhan, where he talked about the medium is the message. Do you think that when we have different availability of the medium through which we're viewing certain things, so social media is one that you've mentioned, how does this idea of media convergence and how does this maybe affect the message that an ethnic media source might be creating?
Okay, I feel that Derek was one of the reviewers for this paper, though I'm sure he was not.
I am anonymous. I stand behind my mask.
Okay, we did not receive the exact same question, but a very similar question. How media convergence impact about the creation of message? Well, unfortunately, that is one of the findings that you might be surprised. The content which is produced for print version of the newspaper, for example, it is exactly published in the online version of the newspaper. And that doesn't happen not only in ethnic news media, but that I found in my study that I conducted in mainstream news media. So on paper, theoretically, media conversion has happened. So we have the offline version, we have online version, then we have the social media version of the story. However, it's just like cut, copy, pasting, unfortunately. We teach our students to have a different version of the story when you broadcast it in different platforms. We teach them in journalism schools. Unfortunately, in practice, it is not happening. Why? I feel that news organizations, they have a valid justification. They don't have a staff. If you go back and see the dynamics and the ownership structure of many of the news organizations, they don't have a staff. So they rely on the same staff. They just create one story, which is disseminated across different platforms without seeing the theoretical underpinning of the format of the story, whether they have to change. So in one sense, we don't blame journalists playing with the format of the story and not taking care of the media convergence. I think they are more compelled to the structure within which they are operating. And at the end of the day, it is their job. So there is a huge gap between theory and practice. In theory, everything is happening. Media convergence is happening. We have do's and don'ts about the formats of different types of storytelling across different platforms. But in practice, you can do the content analysis and you will laugh. You will see the same published story in a newspaper, cut copy pasting of that or a brief of that story in the online content or maybe any other digital format. That is also happening in Russia also. So many of the people, the news consumers, I think we feel as if they are dumb or they don't have time to differentiate between the format of the story. But we as an academic, we know that. We teach our students how to create stories for different media platforms. However, in practice, it doesn't happen in news organizations. So they go for a cost-cutting strategy in terms of the human resource. So we cannot blame journalists themselves. We can blame it the gap between theory and practice, you know.
And the funding, I suppose, if they're not getting the...
Even if the news organization, they have funding, trust me, it's all about profit. At the end of the day, it's all about profit, unfortunately. And everything looks so beautiful in theory. The journalism looks so beautiful in journalism schools. Communication is beautiful in books. Communication and journalism are not beautiful in practice.
So this is why we stay in our ivory towers, because it's It's truly beautiful if we don't get our theory dirty by practicing.
Absolutely. It's scary out there. No, I'm going to shut myself in my office for a while after this.
I am going to bug you a little bit with praxis here and the idea that even though this article hasn't yet come out, it's part of a larger project and you've been out in the field and you've been talking to people. What kind of conversations have you seen started by the attention to media convergence and ethnic news media in these places?
I think now, back to Pakistan, we have seen that there is a growing interest in research about ethnic news media. So we have observed that many of the local institutions, they are asking their PhD candidates to move beyond mainstream news media and asking a student that you can have research about ethnic news media also. So I think that is one positive implication that I can notice very recently. So I'm very happy that now in the past 3 or 4 years, whatever the work that we have contributed, we are now noticing a lot of postgraduate researchers, they are interested in doing research about ethnic news media. I know one of my colleagues, he is working at University of Kansas. He is original Pakistani with an ethnic identity, and he was inspired to do a research project. And I was like, look, you can give a better voice than me, maybe. And he did that project. He already got his publication. And I'm super happy that at least people are now working into some of the things that are ignored before.
It sounds like you have a pretty good voice, though.
I'm not an influencer, but at least I try, because I have grown up in an environment where we get inspired with the scholars who are big names in the global north. Pardon me for using this terminology, but what I feel as an obligation to motivate at least researcher to follow their footstep. Try to produce quality research. If I can be an influencer for that, I will be super happy.
On that note, what exactly are your plans for the future now that you have published this? What's next?
The next is based on the finding of this article. If you have noticed, it has highlighted the issue of digital divide back to Pakistan and Russia. One of the very fascinating things about my wonderful colleague, Anna, she's a wonderful friend of mine also. She's Associate Dean of International Affairs.
This is Anna Gladkova,
Yes, she is a wonderful friend of mine, and she has done tremendously into digital divide. I have worked also back to Pakistan, and we believe that now we can investigate how digital inequalities impact journalistic work. We are not very motivated to work into mainstream news media because I have already worked on that. I have already contributed a research into digital inequalities impacting evolving newsrooms, taking mainstream news media as an example. So I think we will be coming back to ethnic news media once again to investigate how digital divide impacts the newsroom practices of ethnic news media.
Well, we wish you all the best with this, Sadia, and thank you very much for coming to share your research with us and educate us and talk to us about this topic. I feel like I've learned a great deal today.
Utterly fascinating. Thank you very, very much for making the time for us.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you, Mary. And I really enjoyed talking to you this morning.
Oh,
that's love.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.